Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you ace your exams at school and university through the psychology of high performance and the science of studying smarter, not harder. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the Cambridge-trained memory psychologist and exam success coach, William Wadsworth!
Hello and welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast. Today we're kicking off a series on my favourite of all topics, memory and learning. To lay the groundwork this week, I'm welcoming award-winning teacher-educator Peps McRae and author of the ultra-concise, high-impact teaching series back to the podcast. Peps may be familiar to regular listeners for his episode a little earlier in the year, episode 136, Helping Us Understand Motivation. It was really well received. And so I'm really excited to welcome Peps back today to talk about memory fundamentals. I first heard Peps present on this. It's actually the first time we met when we shared a virtual stage as part of a sort of seminar on effective revision. And I was really, really impressed by the way he explained so clearly exactly what is going on in our brain when we learn things and store them in memory. Uses analogy really beautifully to help build a kind of really deep intuition about how it all works and what's going on. So even if you're kind of familiar with some of the basics on the psychology of memory and learning, I hope there are still some new insights today to help take those intuitions you have about your memory and how it works to a new level of clarity, with the goal of, as always, helping us study smarter for our upcoming tests and exams. Towards the end of the episode, there are even a couple of slightly more quickfire questions that I put to Peps, things like why knowledge matters and whether it's better to learn on a screen versus on paper. So stay tuned to the end for Peps's take on those. Without further ado, let's welcome Peps McRae back to the podcast and dive right in to Memory 101.
Hey, thanks for having me, William. Delighted to be here.
Thanks ever so much. Well, look, by way of introduction, I wondered if we could start by just going right back to basics. So perhaps you could just spend a moment just giving us a little bit of an overview of a kind of the basic cognitive architecture of memory and what's going on when we learn.
Sure. So for me, I think it's best thought of as a system of two interacting parts. You know, we can think about it in much more complex ways, but I think that's the most powerful way to think about it from a learner's perspective. And those two parts are long-term memory and working memory. Our long-term memory is best thought of as a kind of like mental map of the world that we try and construct, create, fill in as we go through life, both in terms of how we understand the wider world, but also in terms of how we understand the subjects that we're trying to learn in school, in university, in life. Another word for that map or long-term memory is knowledge. So we can think about, you know, the map being knowledge in the broadest sense, knowledge that includes things like skills and dispositions and identity even. So like really knowledge is all of that, everything we know and who we are. The other component then is this component called working memory. And if long-term memory is our mental map of the world, then working memory is best thought of as the pencil or pen or whatever it is that draws that map or authors that map or changes it. And if long-term memory is best thought of as knowledge in its widest sense, then working memory can be thought of as attention or thinking, or those two kind of concepts molded together.
Yeah.
And in short, we can kind of package it all up by saying what we think about is what we end up knowing. Yeah. Or what our working memory pays attention to is what we end up changing in our long-term memory. And that's the kind of goal of learning and education more generally, is to harness our working memory, you know, direct our attention towards something, do some thinking about that thing in way that changes our long-term memory.
Well, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. I really like the way you talked about the sort of long-term memory being that map and working memory being the kind of pencil that writes that map. An analogy that's sometimes used for, I guess, long-term memory in particular is it's a bit like your library. It's the big store of all those books representing the knowledge and things you've acquired through your lifetime, through your learning. Why is a library not necessarily a fantastic analogy for long-term memory in particular?
Okay. Why is a map not necessarily a fantastic? Yeah, so this is a really good point, because the analogies that we kind of hold in our heads about how memory works can influence, you know, how we think about it, and then as a result influence what we do. So it's important to kind of be aware of some of the limitations of those analogies and, you know, try to find better ones to plug into that map, even though it might not be the right thing. Now, the reason thinking about our memory like a library or a computer filing system or even a map is a problem is because memories are a much more organic thing. They are hard to kind of plant, if we think about them more through like a organic analogy. They're hard to plant. They take a lot of effort to grow, so we have to kind of water them, as it were, and nourish them. And then even if we do get them to take root and to begin to flourish, they're constantly, you know, subject to interference, being jostled around and potentially killed off by other memories, by other plants in the local vicinity. And so I think it's probably much more helpful for us to be thinking about memory as something like a rainforest or a set of paths that are trod through a wooded forest or a forest, rather than something like a computer filing cabinet or a library or even a map that is, you know, very firmly written down and never going to disappear. Maybe a better map analogy might be drawing a map with one of those disappearing ink pens, as it were. Right. And you have to like draw over a few times for it to actually stick.
This analogy of it being hard to get memories to plant, I wonder if maybe we could talk a little bit more about that. So why is it hard to get them to plant, and what can we do about that? Are there any sort of practical lessons for us when we're doing our learning to help make it a little bit easier to get them to plant, so to speak?
Yeah, sure. So the kind of comes back to this. Let's try and use the map analogy a little bit more. So any map is only a very, very, like, only represents a very small portion of the terrain, of the reality that it tries to draw out. If you think about it like a, you know, map of the world, it's really only showing, you know, the outline of a country and with a name. Whereas, you know, if you really were to zoom in on that country, the detail is just almost infinite, right? But a map can't draw every single tree and every single pillory on every single blade of grass, right? It has to kind of zoom out, decide, we're going to pick this thing, going to pick the name of the country and the shape of it, and we're going to represent that. And our brains, the mental map that our brain constructs, our memories construct, is somewhat similar. We cannot possibly memorize all of the information that we come across in our lives. There's just simply far, far too much. Just imagine, you know, if your brain memorized every single thing you looked at, every single thing you heard, it would just be completely overburdened, overflowing. It would almost be too full to be useful. And as a result, our brains have taken a much smarter path to using themselves, and they've decided that they're really only going to put stuff in memory that they think is really useful. Okay, useful for our success and our survival in life. But that potentially presents a bit of a challenge for those of us who are trying to learn some stuff that our brain might not think is highly valuable to our survival and success. And so we've got to try and like approach it in a bit of a workaround way to achieve the goals that we have, that we want, and despite our brains' own intentions. And I'm sure there are various things that we can do to try and increase the chances that we plant that memory, as it were. I'm sure some of them you've discussed before on the podcast, and we've already talked about them. The more times we revisit an idea, the more likely we are to, you know, inscribe it in memory, the more likely we are to remember it. And the way that we revisit that idea matters too. If we, you know, are trying to remember an idea that we read in a book, if we just reread that idea over and over again, yes, it will have a little bit of a positive effect on our ability to remember it, but nowhere near as strong an effect as if we tried to remember it, that idea, without rereading it. For example, by quizzing ourselves or just trying to write down on a blank piece of paper everything that we remembered from that book, the act of kind of draw the memory out of our brains seems to be much more powerful than the act of just putting it back into our brains again. We call that retrieval practice. And so retrieval practice is an effective way to increase the indelibility, increase the permanence of the ink on that map. But we can also do other things to increase the chances that the memory we plant takes hold. For example, another important factor is how well connected the new idea is to the stuff that we already know. And so if you try to, I'm trying to think of an analogy here. If you try to, you know, if we think of a Lego analogy, if you're trying to build a wall and you're trying to put like a new Lego brick, a new idea into your memory, and yet if you're just trying to like stick that Lego brick onto a bunch of rocks that you found on the beach, it's not going to stick very well, okay, because it doesn't really fit. Whereas if you have, if you find the place in your memory where there are already some Lego blocks, you've already started to lay some similar types of understandings, the Lego block will sit much better onto that existing stack and stick there much better as well. So those are kind of two strategies that we can deploy. The first is retrieval practice, trying to draw that remembering, but drawing it out. And the second strategy is trying to build on knowledge that we already have rather than just trying to put an isolated bit of knowledge into our brain that floats around a little bit without any tethers.
Nice. Nice. Tell us a little bit about cognitive load theory. I think it's had a lot of attention in certainly here in the UK in the kind of education world. And it's not something we've, I think, ever talked about on the podcast. So I feel we should. And it's, I think it's another quite important part, isn't it, of particularly that bit about sort of building initial understanding and potentially could get in the way of forming initial understanding and getting that seed to take root in the first place.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So well, we talked about, you know, memory being made up of these two interacting parts, working memory or thinking and attention, and long-term memory or knowledge. Now, understanding the kind of features or the pros and cons or how those different parts of memory work can really help us to harness that memory system. And if we zoom into the working memory part to begin with, one of the main features of it is that it can only really pay attention to and think about a very few number of things at once. Okay, now the analogy here is one of juggling. All right, so everybody's seen people juggle. Hopefully, you know, a few people have tried to juggle, and you will have realized that certainly as a novice, as a beginner juggler, if you try to, the minute you try to juggle too many balls, you will just drop them all. Okay, you can juggle one. Most people can, you know, juggle one.
One's okay.
One, yeah. We can do. Okay, two, potentially, we have to work really hard, concentrate really hard to get two going. And it's actually only with quite a bit of practice that we can get to three. And the same is, a similar kind of idea is very true for our working memory. We can basically only really pay attention to and think about one or two things at once. And the minute we try to think about too much at once, our brain basically drops all of the balls and we end up thinking about nothing at all. And if we end up thinking about nothing at all, then we end up not changing our long-term memory, not changing our knowledge at all. And that is the basis, the big idea of cognitive load theory.
So what are some of the practical implications of that if we're doing our learning? What are some of the things we might want to do or not do to help us overcome those limitations?
Yeah. Okay. So there are some, you know, fairly big implications here of this idea that we can only really pay attention to or think about a few things at once. And the first is that we should try to reduce the number of distractions in our environment whenever we're trying to study. So if we can only pay attention to a few things at once, and in our, you know, study environment, there are lots of other things that are happening as well as this, you know, the stuff we're trying to study, then our brain will be torn between all of those different sources of information, as it were, and we will be able to pay less attention to the study material, the stuff we're trying to learn. What kinds of things might we be able to, what might I be talking about? Well, music is a classic one. You know, research suggests that if there is music playing, particularly music that has lyrics in it, while you're studying, it makes it really hard for you to pay attention to and end up remembering and understanding the material that you're trying to study. If there are lots of visual stimuli, lots of posters or even a TV in the local environment, then again, that's going to be, you know, much harder for your brain to pay attention to the thing you're trying to study. Even the presence of a mobile phone in the vicinity, even apparently, okay, there's been some really interesting research that suggests that even when it's turned off, it's still has an impact on your ability to study, because part of your working memory, part of your very finite and precious working memory, is being devoted to kind of listening out for that phone, because you know at some point it may ping and, you know, have some important information relevant to your survival and success. Of course, other distractions include people coming to distract you, or if you're studying in a cafe and there are other people around, all of those kind of social distractions can be pretty significant. Now, the interesting thing about many of these distractions is that not only do they consume a small part of your working memory and mean that you can't pay all of your attention to study, they also sometimes force you to drop all of the balls. So, for example, if a phone notification goes off, all of your attention might shift to that immediately. As a result, you drop all of your balls. Or if somebody comes into the room and interrupts, or if something important happens on the TV that's on in the background, or somebody uses some crazy language in the song you're listening to, whatever it is, you might drop all of the balls. And if that happens, it can actually take quite a bit of time for you to get the balls back up in the air. And so even though that little like phone notification ding took less than a second, the amount of time that it kind of robs from your learning can end up being a couple of minutes, because it takes us time to get the balls back up in the air again. So first big kind of implication that we have from this idea of cognitive load theory is to really reduce the number of competing distractions from our study as possible.
So I think that's so interesting. And I think it's also worse than just the 2 minutes, because even after you get your brain back on task and back onto what you were doing, like that thought can kind of pop back up again. You know, if you sent a message back to a friend, if you sent a reply back to a friend, 3 minutes in, 5 minutes in, 7 minutes in, it kind of start to mind wonder and wonder, oh, I wonder if he's replied yet, or I wonder if she's got the message, or I wonder what she's going to say, or, you know, whatever. So it sets up future distraction as well. And I also think, and I don't know if I've seen any evidence on this, and I don't know if there is any, but you know, my strong instinct is when you switch back onto your task, you're also much more likely to make mistakes at that point while you're kind of picking up your previous train of thought. You know, if you broke off halfway through a maths problem or halfway through a paragraph, you're more likely, I think, to make a mistake at that point as you're trying to pick up those threads of what you were thinking previously.
Yeah, I am not aware of any research on that, but I'd be willing to bet that you're right. If there was a study done, I'd be pretty sure that, you know, it's a bit like being interrupted while drawing a map. Having to come back in, it's really hard to like pick it up so that the line is perfectly like aligned with where you left off, as it were.
Okay, and so you set us up quite nicely to carry on the conversation. You said that's the first sort of big implication. So managing those sort of external distractions, helping us reduce that kind of working memory overload, that cognitive load. Is there anything else we need to think about too?
So maybe one other useful implication to touch on of cognitive load, because there are a whole set of implications around long-term memory as well. Another implication of cognitive load is that because we can only think about so much at a time, we have to be extra careful about what we devote our thinking to when we're trying to learn really complex stuff, okay? So to try and make this a little bit more easier to understand, let's think about if you were trying to learn about how to calculate the area of a sector, right? So a sector is a part of a circle, and to work out the area of it, you have to know and be able to apply the formula for the area of a sector or the area of a circle and be able to divide it. But often you also have to be able to do some multiplication or division and addition. And because our brain's only really able to think about a few number of things at once, it can be sometimes hard to do all of those things at once in a short space of time. And so as a learner, it's probably better for us to place our bets or to be specific, like what is the thing that I really want to learn in this study session? Is it the times tables part or is it the area of a sector part? And it's probably going to be the area of the sector part, okay, in this situation. And as a result, unless you are really fluent in your times tables, it might be worth having a times tables grid or even a calculator on hand. Because what that does is it basically outsources, you know, it gives you an extra arm in the juggling analogy, okay? It allows you to outsource some of your limited working memory capacity to this other thing. So you don't have to, your brain doesn't have to do that additional thinking of multiplying or dividing, you know, potentially quite, you know, challenging numbers together. And you can pay more attention towards the kind of parts of the problem that are more sophisticated or more challenging, or the things you're trying to learn around the area of a circle. Now, of course, the kind of important thing here is that you don't want to not also pay attention to or think about the times tables piece, because that's really important and future in the exam context, but also in life, being able to rapidly recall and apply your times tables is really important. but it's probably better to build that muscle, build the times table muscle, independently from the question about the area of a circle, right? And so really, this is the term that's used in cognitive load theory is overload. And so what we're trying to do in this situation is to stop our brains getting overloaded and dropping all the balls by just juggling one ball at a time and being really specific about which ball it's going to be at which particular time. Now, the final thing to say here is that if we can get to a point where we're able to recall and apply our times tables really fluently, we've got to the point where, you know, they just come almost without thinking about it, then that kind of acts a bit like a calculator or a bit like a times table grid. It uses a really, really small part of our limited working memory. Again, it's kind of like having an invisible arm that does a little bit of juggling for you. But that only happens when we get to a point where we have a really, you know, fluent recall of that particular stuff.
That's nice. I feel vindicated. I remember taking further maths at school, at an advanced maths course that's offered in the UK, and we all got mocked. Everyone taking further maths got mocked by the regular maths, you know, just taking normal A-level maths, because yeah, we all used we whipped calculators out at every moment. And we all did it. And I don't know, I just assumed at the time we were all getting into bad habits and being lazy about it. We could use calculators in all the exams. It was, you know, it wasn't an exam prep problem. But now I realize, of course, we were being sensible and we were offloading some of our process, you know, to maximize our working memory for solving the challenging problems in front of us.
Absolutely. Yeah. As long as you do it strategically, that's the key. Yeah. Just using a calculator all the time will end up leaving you, you know, in a point where if you're not able to do the times table stuff in your head, then that is going to be limiting it.
Yeah. You know, another kind of example within this context would be learning the formulas or learning the kind of the procedure you need to work through. And again, I guess that maybe that's something you can kind of break out as a separate thing to practice, if you're particularly at first when you're starting to get your head around a new type of problem at first. You know, don't worry about trying to recall the exact formula for the sector of a circle to start with while you're still figuring out how to do the actual calculation. You know, look it up. But as you're saying, like, you definitely need to be strategic about it. And at some point, you do need to do that formula learning if you're going to be expected to know it.
Writing frames are another, you know, helpful kind of scaffold, as it were, or way to offload memory. If you provide yourself with a kind of writing scaffold to work within, then you don't have to think about the overarching, you know, structure of your response. And the, you know, some of the simplest writing scaffolds are just a series of questions, right? So you just decide, or somebody provides you a list of questions that you have to answer, and that means you don't have to think about the overarching structure of your response. You can just focus on answering the question. And like you say, if you use a computer, then you won't have to worry about spelling either in that moment.
Right. I'm just wondering, we were talking about maths a moment ago, and I know this is your specialist subject, so to speak. I'm just wondering if there are any other handy lessons from cognitive psychology for maths learning in particular.
I think it's a good question. In general, I think the way we learn, or the way our brains are structured, and the material we have to learn in school is more similar than it is different. And as a result, I think there are probably fewer subject-specific learning strategies than you might originally assume. The one that does spring to mind is, because maths is about learning heavily abstract concepts, you know, that's basically what maths is, just abstract ideas. A particular learning strategy that is important is what we call moving from concrete to abstract. Okay. So earlier on, we used this analogy of Lego, and we said that, you know, in order to be able to plant memories in ways that grow and flourish and stay, we have to plant them on solid ground, on ideas that are relevant, that we already know, stuff we already know about. And for maths, that can be a real risk, because pretty much all mathematical ideas are Lego blocks that are potentially floating around without any grounding. And so we have to often create that kind of foundation for any kind of mathematical idea. And that's one of the reasons why people get to a point where they just, you know, math, they don't really get maths, or they find maths really hard. It's often because they haven't built really good concrete foundation They haven't anchored this new idea to stuff that they already know. If we think about a simple concept like fractions, a number with a line and over another number is a very abstract idea. It can mean lots of different things. But if we begin just with a bar of chocolate or a pizza and really get to grips about what a fraction means in that context, or even with multiple pizzas, whatever it is, then that can really help us when we come to really understand that more abstract concept in isolation of our physical world. And that's true probably of many, many areas of maths. If you want to really develop a deep and understanding in ways that you feel confident, make sure that you're able to connect it to something that you already know.
Interesting. Very interesting. So we've been talking a lot about learning and memory and getting stuff to stick in long-term memory. Challenge. It's no longer important to learn and know things because you can just look it up on Google. Discuss.
Okay, yeah. Right, so this is an interesting idea that gets thrown around sometimes. And whilst it is amazing that we can, almost look up any bit of information on the internet, it's a wonderful thing that I couldn't do when I was a kid. We've got to be careful about assuming that that can replace our own memory in many ways. Because if we rely on looking something up, it means that we don't have that idea in our heads, and we need ideas in our heads to be able to think with, okay, not just think about. And so if we use the maths example that we had earlier, if you're just always going to be looking up your times tables, then that means that you're never going to be able to spot the natural times tables that exist in the wild or even in your exams. And you're never going to know that, 64, well, that's always going to be like a product of 2/8, and again, divisible by 4 and 2 as well, because you need to have that knowledge in your head to be able to see all of those connections almost immediately. And same is true for history. Without an understanding of all of the various kind of things that happened in the past, it's very hard to then quickly see the connections between stuff that's happening in our present day. And so whilst, yes, it's great to be able to look stuff up, it's even better if you can look that stuff up internally. If you can get into your own memory, then it just makes your understanding of the world, your analysis of the world, even more powerful.
Fantastic. Okay. Is it better to read on a screen, which is increasingly the default for a lot of people these days, or on paper?
Right. Okay. Now, I spend a lot of time reading on screen, and so I'm not against screens, and certainly not against technology. I'm a huge fan of technology, but repeated studies, lots and lots of evidence suggests that actually we tend to understand better and remember more whenever we read on paper. Okay, so there's what's called a screen inferiority effect, okay, or a paper superiority effect, okay. Now, it only really is true for non-fiction stuff. So if you're reading a fiction book or a kind of a narrative, anything that's a narrative, then the effect disappears. You can read it on screen or on paper. It doesn't really matter. You'll understand and remember it as much. Or if it's really, short bits of information, it doesn't matter either. But if you're talking about stuff that you're trying to learn for an exam, which is normally nonfiction, and it's more than 500 words, which most subjects are, then actually the evidence suggests that you'd be better off trying to read that on paper. Now, there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that when you read on screen, your brain has to do a little bit more juggling. Often it involves scrolling, and so your brain has to not only track the words, but track where they're moving on the screen as you scroll. There's also as we've discussed earlier, the kind of threat of notifications in the background, depending on the kind of device you're using. Yeah. And then finally, over the kind of last 10 years or so, due to our experiences with using digital technologies, our brains kind of taken on a different way of approaching them, because often, you know, using digital technologies ends up being a very much a skim reading type affair, and because of the kind of incentives that come, or quick incentives that come with social media, we end up as humans treating stuff that we read on screen in a slightly shallower way to how we treat stuff on paper. And so all of those wrapped up are the reasons that if you really, really want to, you know, maximize your understanding and memory, then it's probably better to be reading a textbook or, you know, a printed out version. Now, of course, there are flip sides to all of this. Technology can help us to organize lots of information. We don't want to be printing loads of stuff out because that's really bad for the environment. And I'd say there are probably some devices that are better or worse than others. So research is pretty clear, but there are lots of trade-offs that you'll need to make. And so I'm not suggesting you just go and print the whole internet out, essentially.
Be selective about what's most important.
Yeah, and use a textbook. I think if you have, you know, a print textbook, if you have the option.
Fantastic. But a couple of my previous questions were inspired by, as I'm sure you spotted, your Evidence Snacks email series, which you write for teachers. I've been getting them recently, and they're great emails. We will, of course, link to where people can sign up for that email series in the show notes, and I'd highly recommend people do, particularly if they're a teacher or an educator themselves. I just wondered if I could ask a slightly broader question based on this idea of kind of getting evidence out into education. And, you know, you're obviously most familiar with the kind of the UK school system. And, you know, it's been quite an exciting time in recent years for getting evidence into the teaching profession. I'm just curious for your kind of taking a step back, like, what's your perspective on how far we've come and perhaps where we still need to go from here?
Yeah, I do think it has been a really exciting period in the history of the profession. In the last 10 years, I'd say, in particular, 15 years ago, there were very, very few schools, very few teachers who were employing evidence-informed approaches, evidence-informed strategies routinely within their classes. I was a teacher then, and I was doing all sorts of crazy stuff. I was using BrainGym because, somebody had told me that that was an effective strategy. I was catering to what I perceived were people learning styles. And we know now that both of those things are a myth and potentially actually, you know, damaging for learners. I'm pretty confident that in England, at least, there is going to be a lot fewer teachers using strategies like that, and a lot more teachers leaning on strategies that have some form of evidence base, such as retrieval practice, some of the implications from cognitive load, even ideas from the kind of more social and emotional side of the evidence around belonging and motivation. And so, yes, I think we have come a long way in 10 years. I find it really encouraging and heartening, because the more our practice is grounded in evidence, the more chance that it helps our students to learn stuff and develop agency and be able to go out and live great lives. However, there's still a hugely long way to go before we can begin to rest on our laurels, if we ever get to that point. And I think a useful contrast is the field of medicine. In medicine, they have a really strong research pipeline. There's constantly really high quality, relevant evidence coming through the door that they're able to grapple with. There is sufficient funding that allows doctors to be able to study for many, many years and continue to study throughout their professional lives. And they have, the NHS has a huge amount of support from the public at large, which enables that kind of funding and status that comes with it. Now, we don't have those things in place quite yet. However, I think that will be the next 10 years You know, if you come back to me in 2033, William, I'd like to hope that we've made some progress in some of those aspects. And together, those things hopefully will allow us to take another step towards being an even more effective profession.
Peps, this has been such a great conversation. Thank you for being so generous with your time and your wisdom. And if anybody does want to pick up the threads, find out more about your work, your books, what you do, give us some signposts. Where can we go next?
Sure. So I have a website that I try to collate everything that I talk about on. It is pepsmcrae.com. And if you, there's not too many Pepses out there, fortunately. So you just search for Peps, you'll probably find me, Peps Teacher, Peps Education, something like that. And that'll lead you to, you know, things like my books, which are predominantly written for teachers, but I've been told are fairly understandable by a wide audience. And that'll direct you to my weekly newsletter, which is called Evidence Snacks, which essentially tries to help teachers and potentially learners to keep up to date with the latest thinking and evidence around effective teaching and learning.
All highly recommended. Definitely come with a stamp of approval on all fronts. Peps, thank you so much. It's been really great to talk today. Thanks again.
Thank you, William. Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Thanks again, Peps. This episode was actually recorded last year, so we're already into 2024, so it's now just 9 years to go before our 10-year check-in that Peps was proposing there. We also mentioned his Evidence Snacks series that he writes for teachers. At time of broadcasting this episode, we are in the midst of publishing a short co-authored series of that email newsletter, in which we're sharing some of my research and my favourite ideas on how to help students study smarter. The Evidence Snacks series, as Peps says, is designed for teachers, and it's incredibly popular. Peps puts a huge amount of effort into each week sharing a really useful, high-impact, really, really interesting little bite of evidence with some instant practical takeaways you can apply in your classroom and at your school to help your students. The first installment of that series came out last week. It was all about the phenomenon of retrieval resistance, as I call it. So why it's difficult for students to do retrieval practice, even when they know they should. And then there are two more in the series over the next fortnight on some of my other biggest lessons learned from 5 years now of teaching effective study strategies. So if you are interested in signing up to that email series, I highly recommend being on Peps's Evidence Snacks list, not just for this current series that I'm doing with him, but just generally it's a really interesting read in my inbox every Thursday morning. I will pop that link in the show notes so you can sign up and get the emails yourself. Before I go, I also just wanted to take a moment to look ahead a little bit on the podcast to give you a flavour of what's coming up over the next few weeks as part of our memory and learning series on the podcast. I've been working really, really hard on this series. It's been a long time putting it together. There's a lot of good stuff coming your way. So just to give you a little whet of your appetite, next week's regular Sunday episode features Aranbir Singh Gill, who is author of a book called Dunlosky's Strengthening the Student Toolbox in Action. A short, concise book in which he talks about John Dunlosky's incredibly influential 2013 review of the evidence on what works and what doesn't when it comes to learning effectively. And Singh does a really nice job of kind of talking about how to put all those ideas from Dunlosky's paper into action. The following week, I'm thrilled to be joined by the man himself, Professor John Dunlosky, the lead author on that piece of research, and himself a really, really passionate advocate for effective study skills. It's, to be honest, a real highlight of my entire podcasting career to be able to interview John Dunlosky. His research has had a huge impact on my life, and I present on his that study all the time. I use it all the time in my own teaching. And so I'm really, really excited to be able to introduce him here on the show and hear directly from him. Some of his favourite ideas, and you know, as always, when I interview the kind of the researcher themselves, I always learn new things and get new insights. So I'm really excited to share that one. And between those two regular Sunday episodes, so next week, throughout the week, weekdays, Monday to Friday, we'll be doing something a little bit special on the podcast and doing a special daily series, an episode each day throughout the week, which we don't normally do. And it's also on a slightly different perspective to normal. So normally we teach study skills to students. But next week, we are turning our attention to all our teachers and educators listening to the show. And I know there's a fair few of you out there. So I thought it would be really nice to do a special little series just focusing on how to teach effective learning. And we've got a really nice set of interviews for you on that. So including some of the most sort of influential voices in evidence-informed education here in the UK, including Dr. Hayley Hughes and Research Ed conference founder Tom Bennett. We'll be exploring different perspectives on how we can teach students to study effectively and about the rise of evidence-informed practices in education generally. So it should be a really nice little series there, particularly if you're a teacher or educator. So looking ahead further into the memory and learning series and back to our usual focus of producing episodes for students, we've got a fascinating interview with Ollie Lovell on cognitive load theory and recommendations for students from this really important principle for helping us think smarter, solve more problems, beat procrastination, score higher marks and more. There's more I would tell you about, but I don't want to overwhelm you. So lots of great stuff coming up. I've been working really hard on this series for you and I'd love to see it get some love. So please make sure you are subscribed to the show in Apple Podcast or following us in Spotify to see the latest episodes as they come out. And if you wish to, we always really appreciate any nice ratings, drop comments on the episodes where you can do that in Spotify now. And of course, if you're listening on YouTube, and of course, do share the episodes, tell your friends and so on. Always really, really appreciate it. So for today, I just want to thank you once again for listening and wish you every success in your studies this week. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Wasn't that wonderful? If you're feeling inspired, why not leave us a rating and a review in your podcast app? It would make our day. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.